Welcome to What Do Sounds Want, a podcast by Radio Papesse and Al Mare, distributed by Nero Editions. This is a podcast about sound, or better to say, about listening, throughout a series of questions and intuitions we have shared while working together on Life Chronicles of Dorothea Iesi, SBU, a sci-fi film and audio novel written and directed by Al Mare. Before we start, please let us give you a brief lay of the land. Life Chronicles of Dorothea Iesi, SBU, is a film, even though there are no images at all. Over a black background, a single voice, in a manner of an audio diary, narrates the many adventures of researchers Dorothea as she extracts and smuggles sound finds from the past. The film investigates the link between data capitalism, technology and value creation, reflecting on the use of archaeological artifacts, archives and memory as instruments for power and control. Its narrative develops from certain premises that are already current in our social-economical system, such as the use of voice data, non-consensual recordings and voice prints. Throughout the episodes of this podcast series, with the help of artists, scholars and researchers, we will attempt to unfold the themes behind the film. It is going to be an intense journey, moving from listening practices as tools to shape the world, or its perception of it, to questions about sonic fiction and sonic weapons. We'd like to invite you to challenge how you listen, and most of all, to enjoy the ride. Shall we begin? What do sounds want? Audio essays on Life Chronicles of Dorothea Iesi, SBU. A podcast by Radio Papesse and Al Mare. On August 4th, 2020, at 18:08, 2,7500 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded in the port of Beirut. The blast was so powerful that it shook the whole of Lebanon. It was felt throughout the entire Middle East, and it was even heard in Cyprus, more than 240 kilometers away. It was detected as a seismic event with a magnitude of 3.3. The Beirut explosion is considered one of the most powerful artificial non-nuclear explosions in history. Powerful enough to affect Earth's atmosphere. But obviously, the atmosphere wasn't the only one affected. Thousands of people lost their homes, got injured, hundreds lost their lives, and for all those who experienced it, there is a before and an after. And much of it has to do with the sonic elements of the event.
The shared experience of listening to that, to the Beirut explosion, has made a new community of people that might not talk about it, that might not, but are kind of roaming and would maybe potentially even organize very quickly.
Here is Rim Shadid, who is the current director of the Beirut Art Center and one of the co-curators of the 2023 Taipei Biennial.
I spoke to different people who all told me what they thought they heard when it was first happening. And most of the people, they heard an air raid. They thought it was an air raid, not an explosion. Or they thought it was a kind of F-16s that were driving low or something. And that's not an empty feeling, actually. people felt that because they've heard that sound before. And in their memory, in their really kind of sonic memory, this is one of the most atrocious sounds you can hear. And this is when you know that you really need to do something in order to, let's say, survive. So the people who had grown up in the Civil War and who are very familiar with all of these sounds, and these are people that, you know, are now in their late 30s, they're not old people actually. When they heard this, they automatically knew what to do. A lot of them, I mean, I hear this a lot, they went and they hid under tables, they hid under before the explosion actually happened. So from one element, this is kind of how I also took the politics of listening. This kind of shared listening experience that some people were able to use to disrupt this kind of what was happening and literally survive actually.
With this powerful example of sonic memories, capable of pushing certain responses and collective reactions, Reem Shadid reflects on the relationship we all have with our immediate surroundings. And without necessarily having to go to the extremes of such a dramatic event, like the Beirut explosion, she asks how do we listen to the world we live in, if the way we listen could be used to understand it or to disrupt certain power structures. These questions brought her to the notion of sonorous territories as defined by Deleuze and Guattari in their publication from 1980, Mille Plateaux.
Sonorous territories is kind of how you mark space through rhythm. There are certain things that you incorporate rhythm, whether vocally or not, or you start listening to specific things that give you a rhythm of that kind of maybe gives you some order within the chaos that you're in. It's kind of a safety almost, or it helps to kind of take some control over kind of a chaotic situation that you're in. For me, I mean, rhythm is kind of a metaphorical pace at which things are happening.
But that's not only it. Rhythm helps to make sense of things as sounds shape the world and our perception of it. Roland Barthes said that the first thing that power does is to establish a rhythm, and rhythm is political. But who or what establishes the rhythm? Who or what controls it?
How do we listen when the sounds or the soundscape that we constantly exist in suddenly kind of shifts? We're talking about somewhere that is your home, that you have a certain rhythm that you operate within, actually, and then suddenly it kind of completely sounds different.
Those shifts in the soundscape happen whether we acknowledge them or not, and they somehow reflect on how we inhabit the space we are in. They could be triggered by something shocking, like the explosion and its aftermath, or by something subtle, like the kicking in of generators.
This constant shift that our listening operates is, to me, the core of critical listening and of a way of experiencing and practicing sound in a non-authoritarian way.
This is Juliette Vauclair, a French independent researcher, producer, and sound critic, whose work and thinking is central to the whole evolution of Life Chronicles of Dorothea Yezi, SPU. Similarly to Reem Shadid, Juliette Vauclair interrogates questions of politics of listening, positionality, and attunement.
I think probably we should start with the criticism of capitalism, really, as far as categorizations are concerned. What I mean by that is that the capitalist ideology that we live in is one that is heavily relying on categorizations and very falsy ones, actually, on binary categorizations. And as far as sound is concerned, that, for instance, takes the form of defining what a good sound and what a bad sound is, what's a repellent sound and what's an attractive sound is.
Vauclair challenges those binary categorizations by promoting listening as a tool for critical thinking and emancipation from predetermined or assumed constructions. She criticizes the assumptions regarding the use of sound in public spaces as a tool for social control.
Actually, individually and collectively, we do have some control over our sound environments. And I think we should never forget that the best way to fight against any kind of industrialization of listening is precisely to make our listening more specific every time. The more specific, I think, the more you can share it with other people. Because industrialization is not a way of sharing. Well, this is where you exercise your freedom, and this is where also you you build the knowledge that listening can offer you.
In Juliette's words, we, the listeners, have agency. We all experience shifts in the way we perceive sound as much as the same sound will be experienced differently throughout time and space. In other words, context matters.
The way we listen to things and how we listen to things and what things we listen to, that is absolutely not natural, that is not universal, and that is always culturally and socially constructed.
So listening is not universal. We keep repeating this, and somehow it implies that the understanding of the world that we get from listening practices cannot be universal either. We are not pushing for an extreme relativism here, but for us, this is a reminder of the importance of questioning some of the terminology frequently used when talking about sound, and to keep it with Juliette, about or against the industrialization of sound. And this brings us to ideas of sound objects and effects. The term sound object, or objet sonore, first came about in 1948 with the French composer Pierre Schaeffer, who in his research for a new form of music focused his attention on the object as the physical material thing that would be the source of a specific sound. The term then evolved from the material thing to its recording, to then land on something more discrete and complete that could be considered independently from its context. But Juliette Vauclair isn't fully on board.
I think it's an interesting tool, but that we also have to be able to criticize it and to get away from it in order to define how you perceive basically any sound. Any sound that you listen to, be it on your headphones, from a podcast, or from the radio, or in the movies, or when you just walk in the street and you don't have any headphones on you, any sound you listen to has some effect on it. You perceive it through effects. And what is effect? In fact, it's the influence of context, of the environment on sound itself. And you cannot listen to a sound outside of an environment.
And to exercise listening as a tool for critical thinking also means to further step away from the idea that sound and listening are natural and historical elements that anyone in any given period of time, in any culture, could experience exactly in the same way. Sound is not neutral, nor it can be neutral, the perception of it. And on that note, citing Kojo Eshun's book, More Brilliant Than the Sun, Adventures in Sonic Fiction, sound studies researcher and curator Giada Della Bontà says,
"Sonic effects and affects operate not only at the level of intellect or imagination. They also extend to how they engage the entire body. In Kojo Eshun's view, the physical aspect of experiencing sound is not in opposition to intellectual perception, and the brain alone doesn't hold exclusive rights to comprehend and perceive sound. Instead, the body acts as a vast, distributed mind capable of holistic thinking and feeling. It harmonizes with various textural, melodic, and rhythmic inputs to such an extent that it, quote, drastically collapses and reorganizes the sensorial hierarchy."
And that's also what we talked about with artist and writer and theorist Brandon Labelle, whose research on sound culture, voice and questions of agency resonate with our investigation within the world of Dorothea Iesi. in line with Juliette Vauclair's push to move beyond the classical definition of sound object, Brandon LaBelle proposes possible different ways of thinking about it.
So sound, for me, is fundamentally a question of relationality, or it sort of opens up this path or perspective onto relationalities. So for me, the object is always somehow in dialogue with something else. And maybe that's also a nice way to think of a sonic object, is that it's actually not a singularity. Maybe it's an interesting object because it is a carrier of multiplicity. Maybe one of the, also the aspects that sound may invite us into is this sense of the subject. So the sonic object sort of is always a little bit alive. And maybe that's part of its power and part of its poetics as well. So I also really appreciate maybe when we get into questions of public space and sound is something that really also activates the spatial relational experiences, is the way that it kind of traffics across worlds, you know, that are both human, non-human, that are public but also very private, that are personal and impersonal, material and immaterial.
And in the words of researcher and curator Giada Della Bontà,
clearly, sound has to do with space as well. It expands in the air, and sound traveling from the emittent to the receiver crosses this air, crosses our bodies, and comes back in a constant feedback loop that links bodies together, body to local communities and places, to social and even religious orders, to metaphysical logic, to memory, to identity. Therefore, the aural space has a very profound relational and expansive and interstitial nature that triggers psychological and emotional reactions, and also physical ones. And such reactions are not merely byproducts of a passive action.
In this constant feedback loop, as Giada Della Bontà calls it, whenever a sonic occurrence happens, whenever a sound object comes to be, it creates sound waves that propagate throughout the environment. So we go back to Brandon LaBelle's word.
There's also a really wonderful way in which, as we know, sound is always, in a sense, leaving objects behind, right? So if we think that a sound happens and it starts from some kind of moment of material friction or a certain kind of material event that is very concrete or object-based, mostly we could say, that is vibratory, frictional, and then sound is produced from that and it sort of leaves those objects or materialities behind to sort of propagate through an environment. And because of that, I think it does really invite this imagination, right? That we have to kind of follow sound wherever it may take us. So it sort of leads us into a lot of imaginative dimensions. And that really, yeah, for me, really becomes the basis for also how we may sort of enter into relationships and enter into spaces through sound. So even when that sound leaves those objects behind to kind of become a milieu in which reverberation is very pronounced, reverberations then become maybe opportunities for, again, how we participate, how we find each other through these reverberations that have become also carriers of voices and bodies and situations. Maybe reverberations become also slightly political in that sense, which is that where or in what sense do I do things to allow certain sounds to travel?
And to think that sound reverberations and their echoes may never stop moving through time and either could also be an exercise in imagination.
I was also, thinking about how, sometimes there's that idea as well, you know, that sort of fantasy maybe about, you know, do sounds ever really stop? Are they just continuing to move through the ether? So there is that sense maybe with recordings that, You know, they may come to us at certain moments that can also carry us when we need it, you know, or give further support in moments, particularly of conflict or crisis. So we can think maybe reverberation is also a support structure or supportive energy that can help lift or give inspiration even to others at later moments in time.
In a similar way, Juliette Vauclair reminds us of the political dimension of sound in public spaces. What is acceptable, who or what controls it or wants to control it, and how do we listen to it?
I think the question of sound and public space is a very political question, because it's, well, my idea is that listening and sound, as far as public space is concerned, should be considered as part of the commons, like the air that we breathe, like some spaces that are not being fenced, for instance. Behind this is also, well, it's the question of, you know, analyzing the public space as a battlefield for different industries, but also the public space as a space where different actors, they will shape the use of the public space through the kind of sounds that they say are legitimate into that space and which sounds are not legitimate.
So sound in public space is essentially a matter of power, of recognition, imagination, and organization. But what about the listener's agency, our agency, that Juliette was talking about before? In her words, our agency lies in being aware that the sonic world around us is a construction, is a fiction.
I mean, fiction, it has a double meaning. It's fiction as far as it's being organized and edited, like this podcast will be. This podcast actually is a fiction too. Everything is edited and organized. And even if you don't edit it, the basic choices that you make when, you know, what kind of microphone you will use, where you will put it, how long you will record, and what you will choose to focus on when you record, all this moment when you will record something will make it specific, and it will immediately put sound into this set of symbolical significances that you cannot listen to pure sound. It's always into that kind of set. But also fiction is not only in the producer's hands, it's also in the listener's ears. That's also where we have a lot of freedom. I mean, freedom and also a very strong ethical imperative.
Listening to Giada Dalla Bontà, Brandon Labelle, Rim Shadid, and Juliette Vauclair, we walked through some of the many questions that may rise thinking of sound in public space, of how listening practices may be used as a tool for critical thinking and for the tuning and retuning of power dynamics, on how sound may shape the perception of the world we live in and how, through its complexities, questions of ethics and power do emerge. In the next episode of What Do Sounds Want, we'll dive headfirst into the role of technology in supporting and experimenting with the production of pervasive sounds. This podcast series serves as a pair to Life Chronicles of Dorothea Iesi SPU, a project by El Mare, curated by Radio Papesse, promoted in collaboration with Timespan, and produced thanks to the support of the Italian Council, a program to promote Italian art by the Directorate General for Contemporary Creativity of the Italian Ministry of Culture. We know this podcast is an intense journey, and unfortunately, we do not have the time or length to unpack all the perspectives mentioned in each episode. But you will be able to find all the references we found to be useful and interesting, together with an extensive bibliography, on neroeditions.com. We hope we have been able to catch your attention, and if you'd like to know more about Life Chronicles of Dorothea Iesi SPU, please visit almareproject.it and radiopapesse.org.